Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. On the 25th of March, 1944, German guards at a prison camp, Stalag Luft 3, discovered a 111-metre-long tunnel, 6 metres below ground and kitted out with electricity, rope trolley and a primitive air conditioning system. 80 Allied prisoners of war had managed to escape, an accomplishment that would become the inspiration for the classic 1963 movie The Great Escape, starring Steve McQueen. This great feat would not have been possible without the help and training of MI9, a secret organization formed in 1939. With me today to discuss how to trick your prison guards and the history of MI9 is Helen Fry, a specialist in British intelligence and author of more than 20 books, including her latest, MI9, A History of the Secret Service for Escape and Evasion in World War II. Helen, many have heard of MI6 of James Bond fame and would also be familiar with MI5 from the news, but what was MI9?
So MI9 was formed in December 1939, and its brief was to gain intelligence from prisoners of war, whether that was enemy prisoners of war that were captured or our allied prisoners of war, enabling them to escape or evade capture. Well, of course, first of all, to evade capture, but then if they find that they've been captured, to find ways to bring them back. Because of the motto, it was very important to bring them back to fight again. And, of course, the value of airmen is just one example. If they're shot down, they're bailing out over enemy territory, you need them in your fighting forces. You need them to gain air superiority over the Luftwaffe. So it's a very interesting philosophy behind MI9, and it's a philosophy of what was termed escape-mindedness. And it's looking at the value, really, of your personnel and, for the first time, really, not enabling them to just languish in a prisoner of war camp, but bringing them back.
And who was Norman Crockett? And why was he selected to be the first director of MI9?
Yeah, Norman Crockett, he was Brigadier Norman Crockett. Very interesting character. I mean, he'd served in the First World War. But he had a very interesting way of approaching a problem like this. And he was the one that coined the phrase, the psychology behind escape-mindedness. So he was kind of unorthodox. And that's something we find about a lot of the personnel, men and women, that work in MI9, that they are quite unorthodox and they have a different way of tackling a problem. So yeah, he was ideal. I just wonder where we would have been without Norman Crockett.
But it's interesting with escape mindedness because this really becomes part of the training of soldiers as well, that you're supposed to escape. That's part of what you're supposed to do. If you get caught, well, first of all, try not to get caught.
Yes.
Very important. But if you get caught, try to escape. So it also goes in a bit of training, and the organisation also is built up to do that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting side of MI9 because it's all very well before personnel are going into action, and they could be air, navy, you know, any of the fighting forces, commandos. It's all very well to kind of say before they go off, you know, please evade capture, and if you can't, escape. But actually, after capture in particular, you know, disorientated, especially if you're an airman that's bailed out, you might be injured, and it doesn't necessarily become a natural phenomenon to escape. And so what MI9 did was to create a 3-week training course that all personnel went through. And it's astounding because the manuals survive. And it's how to blend into enemy territory. And again, you might think, well, this is quite straightforward, isn't it? Well, actually, no, because one of the instructions was, do not walk in a British way. And I'm reading this stuff thinking, this is incredible. What's walking in a British way? But apparently, airman or soldier could be given away just by the way he walks. So little things
isn't
like that.
Isn't that also the walking sticks? Not using a walking stick. Only Brits do that if they don't have an injury.
Yes.
Right?
And get acquire a beret if you're in France. But there's one example, actually, which I give in the book. And it was given in the training manual about an escapee who actually makes it about 400 kilometres across Nazi-occupied Europe. And he's acquired a bicycle and he's done really, really well until he goes through this tiny town and he cycles round the roundabout the wrong way. And the local policeman looks up and thinks, hang on a minute. And it's just things like that. And he was recaptured. So I love that. You know, when I was working through declassified files, this quirky stuff, but it's sensible training. But again, as I said at the beginning there, it's not something you would necessarily automatically think about when you've just, you know, found yourself behind enemy lines.
One important thing, I think, would why you want your soldiers to not only go back and fight, but the longer they stay in a prison camp, of course, the longer they might the risk grows for them giving away information, and it's also they knew, for example, that also because the Brits did it themselves, that you could put someone in a cell with who's actually a spy who gains their confidence, and over time they start to talk about things. So it was, you want them out as soon as possible, I suppose.
Well, MI9 was realistic that it might not be possible to get the sheer numbers out, but actually in the end they did achieve 35,000 Allied personnel, which is a huge legacy.
It's extraordinary.
It's an extraordinary legacy, but again, as part of the training, personnel were taught how to resist interrogation. Also, you know, beware the bottle of whiskey, the befriending technique. Oh, look, under here, there's a training film. Oh, look, under here, there's a hidden microphone. And MI9s had discovered that one of the doctors in the hospital, and I'm not sure if it was Danzig or Stettin, but one of the hospitals near there, if you were found yourself there and you were wounded, he wasn't actually a real doctor. He was an interrogator, a German interrogator. So you had to be really careful. So it's tiny things like this. So what's extraordinary is the training is incredibly detailed across the 3-week period.
Yeah. Well, take us through the first phase of MI9's activities. The first year must have been quite chaotic in, you know, developing technology and messaging and dealing with a disastrous early war effort leading up to the Dunkirk crisis. So how did MI9 adapt?
Well, you see, Norman Crockett had foresight because, and I know we'll probably, I guess, come on to the gadgets, but in selecting some of his personnel, he had the foresight that we would have prisoners of war, because there were virtually no prisoners of war when MI9 was formed, and even into early 1940. But of course, that all changes with the evacuation of Dunkirk. You've got German forces that have swept through and occupied the Low Countries, well, Denmark before that, of course, and into, well, Belgium, as we know, and France. And what we don't realise is that was an incredibly successful evacuation of, I don't know, some 300,000 personnel in those little fishing boats across the Channel. But what people don't really realise is that 5,000 were trapped in hiding and 50,000 didn't make it out. And there were soldiers fighting, Royal Norfolk's or one regiment, for example, that were holding back the German forces and they could not be evacuated. Mm. And so they find themselves trapped behind enemy lines and they make their way in little groups or on their own south to Vichy, France, to Marseille. And so you've got all these soldiers primarily just trapped, and MI9 has to figure a way to bring them out.
Mm. And you were mentioning the gadgets, you know, even though we, you know, there's this recurring scene in the James Bond movies when Bond tests his new gadgets, yes, and visits a Q branch. But the real life Q branch was not a section of MI6, was it? It was actually MI9. And the work, I mean, I think it's almost as spectacular as in the Bond movies, slightly less high tech. But can you tell us how Q branch came about and who was behind it?
Again, this was the foresight of Norman Crockett, who needed somebody who could think outside the box, that could create, or at least make, gadgets small enough to smuggle into camps gadgets like escape compasses and, of course, the very famous printed maps. How do you get those into prisoner of war camps without the Germans confiscating them? And that was the challenge. And it so happened that a certain chap called Christopher Clayton Hutton, he was known as Clutty, that was his nickname, he turned up at the War Office because he'd been called up. And the man at the War Office sat across the desk and, you know, end of the day, just looked at him and said, well, tell me something about yourself. And Clutty looked up and said, well, I've been fascinated by illusionism and escapology. And of course, this chap, I've got just the place for him. And he'd known Houdini, the famous escapologist. And so Clutty found himself before Norman Crockett. And Norman Crockett said, my challenge for you is we've got to get this stuff into the camps. And he left Clutty to invent the most incredible stuff. And as you say, we think of it being Ian Fleming and his Bond novels. But I was staggered in the early part of my career as a historian to find that the James Bond stuff isn't fake at all. It's not fiction. A lot of it is in the MI9 files.
And it's also because, of course, Ian Fleming is he's more involved in MI9 than he is in MI6. Just tell us in what way Ian Fleming has a role in this. He seems to be, you know, almost everywhere.
Yeah, Fleming turns up everywhere. And this is, again, something I found very surprising. So you will have read in the book that he suddenly appears in the south of France, or near the Pyrenees, should I say, at the time when Churchill's ordered the sinking of the fleet, the French fleet. And on the key there is Fleming. It was the 17th of June, I just remember this, 1940. And he's there with King Zog of Albania, who's being evacuated as well with his, I don't know, 20 suitcases of gold and his bodyguards. It's just a bizarre scene. But of course, Fleming, yes, he's at the heart of MI9 because MI9 wasn't just, I suppose if you put it like army, but air intelligence was involved and naval intelligence.
And Fleming, that's where he is actually. Ian Fleming is within the naval intelligence.
Yes. Fleming is within naval intelligence, sort of attached, I suppose you could say attached to MI9, but he actually recruits a lot of the naval intelligence personnel that are attached to MI9, and they go on to do the most incredible roles that we wouldn't normally expect, particularly the women, do some incredible stuff within MI9.
I just want to go back to the gadgets again because I think that you mentioned the compasses and this is an extraordinary banal point. So I just want to make sure that the listeners understand that I noticed myself. But of course, when you escape, a compass is really key.
Yes.
And that's why you see so many different waves of basically creating a compass that can be hidden in different ways, in clothing, in your shaving kit. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how they got it into the prisoners?
So that was one of the first things that Clutty was tasked with, getting miniature compasses. So he had to find a way to scale down the compasses. And I've seen some of these. They are no bigger than your fingernail. They're quite incredible. So not like your traditional army compasses. And it was down to him to think about ways of smuggling that into the camps. Well, you can smuggle it inside things. As you say, in the back of a shaving brush. Actually, they're carrying that with them. So as long as they could keep their shaving kit, they unscrew the back counterintuitively. That was another thing that Clutty realised, that if you screw the thing the other way, the Germans won't find it, and they didn't. And he also did that with the buttons. So every uniform, at least one button behind it had a hidden compass that you unscrewed the wrong way.
Yeah.
So it was down to his genius, really. And if you think about the volume, we're talking about 1.3 million compasses, miniature compasses, were created, manufactured for MI9. And this is all going on in secret, and the factories and the companies that are involved don't always know. But they're smuggling stuff into board games, little hacksaws, things that could be useful to the prisoners. And there's one item I would like to mention, which I just, again, raised my eyebrows when I read it in the files. The prisoners were allowed blankets, So MI9 would send blankets in, ordinary blankets, except they weren't quite ordinary. And the prisoners knew from coded correspondence that if they, and partly from their training beforehand, that if they dipped it in water with a little bit of stuff in the solution, and the solution was smuggled in different ways, capsules, stuff like MI9, then it would come up with a print of a German uniform they just cut round and sewed together. And for me, I think this is all part of MI9 as well. It's the gadgets, but it's also the ingenuity of the prisoners to actually make their own German uniforms to escape.
Because they did. I mean, when I read that, I felt, first of all, it is, you know, it maybe tells you more about my skills in terms of tailoring. But I realized, like, even if they gave me, you know, the full pieces, it wouldn't look like a German uniform when I've been trying to get to tailor it together. But they produce an enormous amount of clothing as well. That's when when it comes to these great escapes, they really were working almost day and night.
Yeah, and again, it's about, remember what I said about philosophy, the whole escape mindedness. But behind that, you know, again in the manuals, that if a prisoner is busy creating and making stuff, and of course in the camps the German guards did allow them, the commandants allowed them to have theatrical display, you know, and to actually paint backdrops to their plays. Well, of course, actually, if you're sending stuff like painting, that can be used for other things. So as long as you keep your prisoners busy making stuff, MI9 manual, if it moves, nick it, because you'll find a use for it. So they are pinching all sorts of stuff in the camps and reusing it, but it's keeping them mentally sane in captivity, and that's hugely important.
What also seems to be hugely important is the Geneva Convention here, because we're talking about things that are getting stuff in to the prison camps. They have theatrical displays, they keep busy, do all these things. And this is all... because of the Geneva Convention, it's the welfare of the prisoners.
Yes.
And so the whole operation of MI9 seems to be sort of built around that you have this route in. Can you explain a bit what kind of rights they had through the Geneva Convention, how it was used?
Yes, so the Geneva Convention, as you say, is very, very important, because according to the Geneva Convention, if a prisoner is captured, or if a personnel is captured, taken prisoner, all they have to do legally is to give name, rank and number. So they don't have to give anything else away. If things get tricky, prisoners knew there's a bit of roughing up and torture going on. Prisoners knew that the longer they could hold out, potentially they wouldn't compromise that information. But of course, no roughing up, torture by the Geneva Convention, absolutely out. And that's why it becomes very difficult. You started with Stalag Luft 3, of course, horrendous war crime, because the vast majority of them were captured. Only four made it back, from my reckoning. And the rest were rounded up and shot. And that is against the Geneva Convention. They should have been taken back as prisoners of war. Mm. So MI9 then becomes quite nervous, particularly around D-Day, whether the German forces will contravene the Geneva Convention. But yes, MI9 totally supportive of the convention, and that allows for parcels and stuff to be taken into the camps.
Yeah. So there are war crimes committed in terms of prisoners, as you just mentioned. But what was the general conditions in these camps? There was another one called Colditz as well.
Yes.
It was quite famous. And you have Stalag Luft 3. There was a few extraordinary escapes facilitated by MI9 from the camps. But can you tell us what the camps looked like, how they were sort of created, and what was going on in there?
The Colditz that you mention was for officers, and the British personnel that found themselves in there used to call it the naughty boys camp. So that if you'd attempted an escape from one of the other camps, and there were lots of them, there was a separation between officer prisoners and non-commissioned. So Stalag Luft 3, from my understanding, was primarily non-officer. So you could find yourself in Colditz. Colditz, which is this huge castle, if I'm not mistaken, it's 11th century, on bedrock. And the Germans believed, you know, look, they're never going to tunnel out of this place. They're never going to escape. It's impenetrable. But in fact, never say never, because there were 8 successful British attempts that got back to Britain, Airy Neave being one of the most famous ones, who just walked out in a German army uniform that he'd made. And then Stalag Luft 3, yes, for the lower rank prisoners, they would, you know, any means to escape. And sometimes those escapes were quite accidental. Mm. You might remember in the book, there is a story of 2 prisoners who are made to paint the white lines in one of the camps. This, yes, is not Colditz, this is one of the other camps. And in the baking heat and the guards laughing every day and, you know, jeering over them. And then, of course, until the day that they just keep painting the white lines out the gates, round the corner, and they run off. And they actually made it back. We don't know who they were. They don't have their names. But again, it was used in the training. And that was just an accidental escape.
Going back to the people at MI9, I find it interesting and fascinating how they're recruited and what they're sort of looking for. Because it's such an extraordinary time. And it's also... what is interesting is it's a big and small world at the same time. They seem to be just like, you know, you give someone the authority to go and get their people, and they can just do it, rather than it's like not like big bureaucracy in that sense that it's sort of created out of sort of nothing. Could you tell me how they did recruit these top people and what qualities they did look for?
Yeah, so we've mentioned Norman Crockett. Of course, he was no lover of red tape, so that was ideal. So you had to... there was a lot of nervousness, actually, in the early days of MI9, being in the Metropole Building, the War Office in central London, where, you know, too many people walking... although there's secret stuff going on elsewhere, you know, too many people in the corridors might, you know, be noticing stuff. So when they moved about 20 miles outside London to Wilton Park in Buckinghamshire, ideal, a country estate, so these men and women could just get on with what needed to be done. And the recruitment process is interesting because the MI9 files don't give many clues. What you really need to do is to look at the personnel and look at their backgrounds individually. A lot of the women were very well educated, private school educated. Some of them spoke languages, even if they didn't need to use it with MI9. In the case of Jimmy Langley, another giant, yeah, like Neave of MI9, and he gets back after Dunkirk, he finds himself having lunch with Claude Dancy, deputy head of MI6. He doesn't know why he's meeting Claude, and Claude thinks there's something he can do. They have drinks. I think it's the restaurant beside the Savoy Hotel. Anyway, yes, it's the Savoy Hotel. Afterwards, he goes home, says, right, report back on Monday. And he doesn't know what he's doing. And this was a thing that was quite common for personnel. They would turn up at an MI9 site and haven't got a clue what they were going to be doing. Mm. And it was the same with Jimmy Langley.
Yeah, it's but you mentioned here the women, and it's interesting because MI9, it's one of the characteristics that they employed many women in key roles.
Yes,
I don't know if there's many women compared to other branches, but first of all, why were they so inclusive in a time when it was less common?
Yeah, this is really, I suppose, about the intelligence services using the right person for the job, irrespective of gender. And I think it is very easy now in, you know, the 2020s to be kind of a feminist and kind of look back and say, you know, women aren't doing this in civilian life. But suddenly, if you look, there are no gender definitions here. It's the right person for the job. And what you find is that women in particular are smashing the roles within MI9. So to give one example, a big example which comes up in the book, MI9 file says, you know, the right kind of woman. I love that, the right kind of woman, whoever she is. The right kind of woman makes as good an interrogator as a man.
Yeah.
Now, this is smashing the boundaries because they are the first and only known female interrogators of the Second World War.
Yes.
Incredible. Who would think? And if they were used to interrogate German prisoners of war, MI9 has some other secret sites apart from escape and evasion, it was really disorientating. The German prisoners couldn't cope. They were not expecting a female interrogator.
Psychologically, there was they had an advantage there just because they were taking it out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, and you also find that within MI9, women are heading various sections, some of them technological sections, which are quite complex and would perhaps require quite a detailed, for that time, scientific understanding of the technology and how it works. And so in one instance, we find a 21-year-old in MI9 headquarters, Catherine Townshend, heading up the whole of this tech section. And you know, creating some of the secret tech units for MI9.
Mm.
Incredible stuff.
Can you tell us a bit about how an escape would, how would it play out from preparation to getting out of the camp and then trying to get home? So we sort of get a sort of step by step, if that's possible.
Well, that's interesting because I assumed when I was going to be working on the declassified files that an escape is an escape, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there are thousands of escapes and there are escape reports because when they got back to Britain, MI9 interrogated / debriefed the personnel. But every single one of those is different. And sometimes there's no set pattern. So sometimes a prisoner would have to work out for himself once he got outside the camp to get as far away as possible. But what's interesting, and this comes in with the escape lines, they had to be careful about seeking out escape lines to protect them. And so what you do find quite often is that airmen and soldiers would hide, and particularly in Belgium, for example, the men and women working on the escape lines knew there's an airman hiding in the woods 3 miles away, 3 kilometres away. Go and find him and bring him out. So that was one way that they just had to sit tight and evade recapture.
Mm.
And MI9 said, somebody will find you. And you think, well, what if they don't? But they did. So I think it's very, very hard to think about an exact process. It's a very fluid, creative. Every escape is quite dynamic and it is different. It's probably not the ideal answer, but that's the reality.
But of course. But the escape lines are interesting because they are sort of fixed or hard. I mean, they make it's certain routes. I mean, they go through the Pyrenees and quite risky.
Incredibly risky. And this was part of the writing of the book that I wanted to understand, because you've got this organisation, MI9, and they're working, doing all the magic that we've talked about, but you need the escape lines. And this is where MI9 relied on thousands upon thousands of, a lot of them women, young women, and men, of course, behind enemy lines as helpers, guides, leaders of the escape lines. And they would escort airmen and soldiers, maybe one or two at a time, sometimes right under the noses of the Germans, through Paris on trains. They find ways of hiding them in plain sight and bringing them all the way down, as in the case of the Comet line, from Brussels all the way down to the Pyrenees and out into Spain to Bilboa. And at any point, hugely risky.
And these people that work with them, the helpers, were they paid or were they just, you know, were they volunteers? How did it work?
Yeah, they're volunteers. And what we don't have are the helpers' files. Interestingly, the MI9 files don't have any history of the escape lines themselves. Mm. So Airy Neave's work and Foote and Langley's books are invaluable as eyewitnesses to these escape lines. So I think that's really important to understand. It wasn't like going into the MI9 files and saying, right, here's the history of the Comet line, here's the history of the Pat line, which operated from Marseille. So that's really, really important. We also don't have the helpers files. It's, again, to protect their identity. So reconstructing that can be actually quite tricky. But MI9's very clear that if you're passed from one helper to another, you must not write down their names, their addresses. You mustn't really remember, just remember what you can, but never compromise their security and identity, because the lines were betrayed with devastating consequences. And the very important key thing here for the airmen and soldiers to realise, look, you know, if the Germans get you, you're recaptured, you're back in a prisoner of war camp, the men and the women that are helping you, they will be shot or sent to concentration camps. And that did happen.
The view we have of these escapes comes mostly from films and TV series, and they were, especially in the 1960s, of course, very much in the popular imagination. How accurate are these sort of fictional accounts of, well, I suppose some are more accurate than others, but if you could give a general view of it.
Yeah, it is interesting because there have been a number of films, as you say, and also television series. And one of the early consultants on these was Pat Reed, who himself had escaped from Colditz. He escaped about 6 months after Airy Neave. And it is surprising if you pitch those against the official camp histories, and those do survive for each of the camps in the MI9 files, they're remarkably accurate. But of course, anyone watching them in the 60s and of course replays in the 70s and today, you might not really realise how accurate they are. But that, I think, for me was quite an eye-opener in working on the camp histories. My gosh, you know, they didn't have to stray very far from the truth.
So how did the Germans respond to MI9's activities?
Well, the Germans didn't know about MI9 as an organisation because it was so top secret, like MI5 and MI6. But they did know, of course, that airmen and soldiers were coming out successfully, that there were escape lines. And so they tried very hard to decimate them, traitors, double agents, that kind of thing. But also, they tried to look for gadgets, and they did find some of Clutty's escape gadgets, but not all of them, because MI9 was sending so many in different gadgets and games and stuff like that. The Germans themselves, and this is something I find very interesting, don't appear to have an equivalent organisation of MI9.
Oh.
Now, that's not to say that German prisoners didn't attempt to escape from some camps, and of course they did. Devizes in central England was one of the camps where there was going to be a mass escape. But by and large, no, there was no philosophy, Norman Crockett's escape-mindedness. There was no equivalent of that in the German services.
So the prisoners then that were interrogated in the UK, they didn't seem to have the same type of training, or is that where we sort of take this from, or how would you see it?
Yeah, so German prisoners were taught before they left, I mean, they were warned, you know, if you're captured, the British will bug your conversations, which we know, and I wrote about that in The Wolves Have Ears, a very clever, again, a psychology, it's part of MI9, the other side of MI9. So they were taught about that, but MI9 created conditions in the camps, partly befriending them, so they turn psychology in their head and they're looking the other way. So you don't have the gadgets. What you do have, though, are German prisoners sending coded messages back now and again. And I'll give one example, if that's okay. There's an example of Trent Park, which was one of MI9's sites at Cockfosters, North London. And this is where Hitler's generals were being held in captivity after captured on the battlefields of North Africa and D-Day and that kind of thing. And six of the women, in their lunch break, the guards were saying to them, well, you know, why don't we learn to teach you, why don't you learn to shoot on the shooting range? And one day, one of those generals looked out across to the lake, and at the side was the shooting range, and saw these women practicing in their lunch break. Of course, they didn't realise it was just for fun. And one of those generals sent a coded message back to HQ Berlin, Churchill is teaching the women to fight. But of course, MI9 allowed that to go through. Yeah. They broke the code, but they allowed it to go through. And I love that. We knew they were doing that.
That's very clever. And speaking of clever, what lessons can MI9 teach us today, you think?
I think it has to be surely the men and women who, you know, this is, I make a point in the book, who come together in wartime, who probably would never have crossed paths in civilian life. They've got a creativity, a way of thinking outside the box, of dealing with situations where, you know, we're fighting for our survival. And I think MI9's men and women were just quite extraordinary and almost accidental. You know, they're finding their way and recruited by MI9 almost accidentally. And that's what I love about this story.
Helen Fry, thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.